Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Thank you for coming. I know it's a difficult journey today. Most of the tube lines seem to be less than efficiently working today. There's always a danger with anything today. I suppose we should start with a prayer, actually, shouldn't we? And so let's go ahead. Father Lord, it's great to meet together and to be able to present plans before you and with one another about how we can help more people in the UK, Father. It's a tremendous privilege to know that you've worked in every single one of our lives. You've extended your grace towards us and enriched our lives spiritually and through our experiences, that we are able to be transformed people, Father. Thank you so much that Hope Worldwide can be part of that, Father, and be part of the process seeing other people's lives transformed because of the support and time and love shown by Christians, Father. I pray that we can continue to do this and do this more. In your son's name I pray. Amen. There's danger with today that I'm actually preaching to the converted. And if I say anything that you think is, yeah, I know that, please bear with me and extend grace towards me. I'm also preaching to those who are not converted via technology here by being recorded. But I just wanted to really say that I've now worked for Hope Worldwide for almost 7 months, and that 7 months has been an incredible blessing to me, to be able to work with the guys who work in Hope Worldwide, JP, Gavin, even Tommy sometimes, and all the other guys. But it's I think the greatest blessing of being able to work at Hope Worldwide has been the opportunity to see the way God has worked in people's lives who had lost hope and who had just sort of, you know, who were at the end of the line, who had nowhere to go and had no option. Excuse me, I'm drawing some anyway, it does sadden me though that really primarily we're only operating in London, and you know, in London the churches have an opportunity to get involved other than just fundraising by being able to witness that transformation in people's lives, to be able to share in that, to be able to sit down with somebody and mentor them, or to be able to host someone in their home by being a stopover host, or just by being able to be around what's going on. And we have had two-step running in other cities before, always run by volunteers, and unfortunately that's never been a sustainable thing. You know, either somebody who was running it moves, changes job, changes circumstances, or it actually becomes just too much work for a volunteer to cope with, and it's unfair. But we would like to really now work much more closely with all the churches in the UK and to be able to try and broaden our reach and help more people. In Romans 12:15-16, in the NIV it says, "Rejoice with those who rejoice, mourn with those who mourn, live in harmony with one another. Do not be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited." And in the Message, the same passages say, "Laugh with your happy friends when they're happy. Share tears when they're down. Get along with each other. Don't be stuck up. Make friends with nobodies. And don't be a great somebody." And I think the Message always portrays things in a very good light. But what strikes me about this passage is that it's actually very easy to laugh with people when they're happy, even if you don't know them. You can travel around and see children laughing in a park and get a smile on your face, and you can see people enjoying themselves, especially on a sunny day, and everyone seems to put a smile on and it makes you feel good and you're around people who are happy. But it's much harder, I think, to actually mourn with those who mourn, because it means you actually have to really care about that person, to actually care enough to mourn for them and with them. And I find that generally, I mean, in the Message one, it says share tears when they're down. And I can't remember the last time I actually cried with anybody else, I have to say. I've cried for myself a few times, but I actually can't genuinely remember the last time I cried for somebody else. And I think it's, I don't know if anyone else relates to that, but I think it's much harder to allow ourselves to feel someone else's pain and to genuinely get that close to people to take that risk even, and to risk feeling that pain, their pain. Especially, you know, if that person is a nobody, you know, maybe someone that we have no reason to get to know. Their relationship with us will not help us. I was with my neighbour yesterday, and he was talking about all the people he gets to know who are tradespeople so they can help him with things on the house. And his relationships are purely about, how can they help me? I'll get to know them. and you know, what the Bible here is talking about is completely the opposite. Is the ability to build relationships, care for people that cannot help us, won't help us, and take that risk to really be hurt ourselves. I want us to ask the question about what really is the church doing about poverty today. And I don't just mean our church, but churches generally, Christianity, Christendom, whatever we want to call it. What is it really doing about poverty, and is it doing enough? I hope worldwide we are actually very grateful for the support we get from all the churches. I think we are in a very unusual and blessed situation for every church to have a weekly collection for us. Is, you know, unprecedented. I can't think of any church that would have a weekly collection for the poor. I've never come across that anywhere, and I think that in itself is actually a remarkable thing, and we really are grateful to all the churches for that. This is a, you know, outstanding, and I think sometimes we just forget that we do that, and really we do need to be grateful for that and thank all the churches regularly for that, because I don't know if churches really understand what impact that really makes for our ability to be able to work with the poor. Last year, the money that came to us from just Sunday collections was enough to employ about 2.5 people in the UK. And so when people put, for the whole year, you know, so when people put, say, £10 in or £1, they're all contributing towards JP's salary or Tommy's salary and all the work that they can do and the impact that they can have. And I don't think people genuinely sort of recognise what impact that really can have, because when we put our £1 or £10 in the basket, you probably don't realise that how far that can extend or really how useful that is for us. And we really want to be thankful for that and say, you know, thank you very much for that. But we're also grateful. Most churches are supporting programs abroad as well. In India, Afghanistan, there are family groups supporting families in Zambia, and as well as individuals doing that. There are people sponsoring children in India. There's so much that people are actually doing, which is fantastic. There's very little that's actually happening in the UK, in our own community. And there are churches that are currently doing something or trying to do something in their congregations, but I think it's very hard for most of our congregations when they're led by people who are not full-time to actually think of everything and to organise everything and find resources to do everything. And I think this is one of the areas that can often be something that is a desire that gets put off because there are more pressing things to do. And one of the things we would like to do is work with churches to help this happen, to help every church to be doing something in their local community that expresses the love of Christ in a way that isn't just about trying to convert people, but that is about really showing the love of Christ to people who might say thanks but might not, in an unconditional way. Yesterday, Rhys Nyland, or Nayland, I don't know how to pronounce his name, in his lesson for the leaders in the morning, shared some of the things they're doing in LA. And one of the things he said, as he was trying to draw people back to some standards that are biblical and that we shouldn't compromise in our attempts to sort of rebuild our churches now. And one of the things he said was that a Christian that never shares their faith is surely not following Jesus. And I'd like to ask today whether a Christian who never helped the poor is actually following Jesus. I have a friend in South Wales who is a Baptist minister, and he did his own little survey on a Sunday morning going around the community where he pastors. And he went around asking people on a Sunday morning this question: what is the first word that comes to mind when I say church? And I want to ask you guys, what's the first thing that comes to your mind if I say the word church? Don't be shy.
Family.
That's a nice one. Great one. Anything else?
Jesus.
Meeting together. Shall I tell you what people on the streets were saying? The first person to answer him said vomit. Most people said paedophile, and a lot of people said hypocrite. Now, I think the church is very disconnected with society, and we have a view of what we are, but that view is within this room and within church buildings, and is not shared by people outside. I think the only way churches are going to overcome that is actually by caring for people and demonstrating their love, not just trying to convert people. And I think this is where hope comes in, and what Hope Worldwide can do. In Matthew 5, verse 14-16, it says, "You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand. It gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men, that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven." And I think this is a calling for all of us, for every Christian, to let our light shine so that men can see our good deeds and praise God. And, you know, I've often viewed that as being, okay, my deeds need to be my evangelism, but I don't know if people who see that are going to praise God, unless they're actually the ones who become Christians. But I think this is a great challenge for churches, because I think we do spend a lot of time thinking about ourselves and what goes on within the congregation. And I think ourselves, as Churches of Christ, we've spent a long time talking about leadership structures, types of leadership, whether it's servant or not, whether it's this, talking about structures and a lot of, you know, a lot of those sort of things. And they're all important, but I think there's a real danger that we could spend another 5 years, maybe 10, 15 years, actually thinking about who we are, what we are going to be, who we're going to be, how we're going to be, and really not get outside our walls and our own little boundaries. Francis of Assisi said, "Preach the gospel at all times, and if necessary, use words." And I think, what a great thing to say, you know. And he was known for helping the poor. I think our collective actions need to achieve something greater that does bring praise to God. And there are many examples around of churches that are able to do this, which I'll touch on later on. I just want to explore a little bit more about, you know, this whole disconnect between churches and society. I want to share an example of something from a long time ago. In 1562, a ship left Britain called the Good Ship Jesus. I want you to, now, you know, that's quite an amazing name, you know. I want you to maybe feed back to me what you think that ship might have been used for. It was a slavery ship, yeah. The thing is, the guys who, the owner, he told his crew that they had to serve God daily and love one another. And yet, they went to Sierra Leone, picked up 300 slaves, and that was the beginning of, that was the first slave ship that left Britain. And yet it was called the Good Ship Jesus. And I think the people on that ship thought they were Christians. It took almost 300 years to finally get rid of slavery within the British Empire. And it took other people of Christian faith to try and bring that about. But even then, William Wilberforce, it took him 18 years to get the selling of slaves banned, and then another 26 years to free the people who had already been sold into slavery, because they weren't freed by that action. That's 44 years to try and change that in a society that considers itself to be Christian. And I think there's a real danger for us to consider ourselves to be Christian before future generations to look back at us and think how crazy they were. How could they think that when the world is in the way it is, and our society in Britain is the way it is? In John 11:32, it says, before I read this passage, I want us to think about what God must feel, what God must have felt when that ship left, called the Good Ship Jesus, knowing what its purpose was, of what he must have felt when the crew were kidnapping 300 people and then having a quiet time. You know, and what God must have felt. Did he weep? Did he get angry? He didn't sink the ship. But, you know, what did he, what would have, I mean, that is amazing. I wonder what he feels today. I wonder what he feels today by the fact that there are whole continents in eternal poverty because of the greed of our society. That people are starving right now because of the petrol price, you know, which is down to our greed and our consumerism. And whether people will consider us to have been Christian in the future because of the way we live our lives today. I think God weeps, and I think he gets really angry. In John 11, 32, it says, "When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, 'Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died.' When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. 'Where have you laid him?' he asked. 'Come and see, Lord.' Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, 'See how he loved him.'" And the message, it's slightly different. It says, "When Jesus saw her sobbing and the Jews with her sobbing, a deep anger welled up within him." And, you know, grief and anger are fairly, can be quite close, can be quite interrelated. But we know that Jesus had an incredible amount of compassion. He represents God's compassion to us. He shows us what it's all about. But he also shows incredible anger. And in Exodus 22, we see the sort of anger that God has about injustice. In 22 verse 21 it says, "Don't abuse or take advantage of strangers." This is the Message version. "You remember we were once strangers in Egypt. Don't mistreat widows or orphans. If you do and they cry out to me, you can be sure I'll take them most seriously. I'll show my anger and come raging among you with the sword, and your wives will end up widows and your children orphans." That's God talking to his people about how they treated foreigners in their land who weren't worshipping him. You know, and you know, it's quite intense, really. And we are called to incredible love and incredible compassion, and to but we're also called to this sort of anger about the world and the circumstances of people's lives around us. We are called to be angry. It's terrible what is going on, and it's not just in the third world, it's down your street and around the corner. In John 12:14 we see Jesus getting a bit angry. "In the temple courts he found men selling cattle, sheep and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. So he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple area, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those who sold doves he said, 'Get these out of here. How dare you turn my father's house into a market?'" And although I'm sure we're not called to necessarily kill anyone or even physically abuse anybody, we are called to have indignation. We are called to act on that. And having a godly indignation with compassion and love, motivated by love, I think is a very powerful thing. And imagine thousands of people having that anger but motivated by love, what they could do. And one of the things I think that challenges us, or will stop us maybe thinking we have to do anything, is that we have a government that does a lot. Something happened in the last 200 years that made Christians give that responsibility of being a light to the government, so that we no longer have to be the light. And I praise God that the government does something, but they're not the answer. God is the answer, and his love expressed through Christians answers things, solves problems. And we can work with the government, we accept their money, but at the end of the day, unless they're expressing the love of Christ as well, they're not going to solve the problems long term. They're just going to try and manage the problem, and the problem will just continue, you know. And you know, we are that light to the world, and that's an amazing thing. that we've been called to. Now, I set the scene why we have to do something. I want to remind us all about who we are as Hope Worldwide. And I want to read out our vision, mission, and some of our values. Because maybe some of you never heard those before. Our vision statement is, our vision is of a world where all disadvantaged and vulnerable people are assisted by those who are able. Our mission statement is, our mission is to transform the lives of disadvantaged and vulnerable people by delivering high quality programs that inspire and involve others in compassionate service. And our values are Christian based, to follow the example of Jesus Christ's sacrificial love and service. Our motive for serving the vulnerable and disadvantaged is faith and love, and there is no ulterior motive. Accountability. We are accountable to God, to our supporters, and to our beneficiaries for the use of our time and resources. We endeavour to be as transparent as possible. Respect. We are committed to good relationships with our partners, supporters, beneficiaries, and colleagues, affirming the equal worth of each individual and showing compassion in all our interactions. We are committed to learning from others. And excellence. We are committed to excellence in both the tangible and intangible aspects of service. We constantly strive for the highest levels of learning and performance in order to maximize our impact. I think, as an organization, we really do strive for high values. We are Christian as an organization. Someone asked me, are you a Christian charity or a charity supported by Christians? I actually felt gutted that someone asked that question. But it's a fair question. We are a Christian charity, and we're supported by Christians, hopefully. And our desire is to follow the example of Christ's love, and that really has to underpin what we do. I desire out of today is to present a possibility that all our churches are able to share in that. Where we can build on the work that's already been achieved. We've learned some amazing lessons. We've been in the UK for 15 years, possibly a bit longer. We've developed, we've grown. I very much respect the people who work Hope Worldwide. They are actually experts in their fields. They are learned people. They are people who operate in an environment with other professionals where they're highly regarded. And Hope Worldwide isn't just a feel-good charity of people trying to do a good thing. Everyone who works for Hope Worldwide becomes someone who can carry their weight in the sector they work in, and who becomes highly respected by partners and organisations. And we really do take what we do very seriously, and we really want to bring glory to God. We want to be able to start new programs that will be the two steps of the future. Two steps started off in very small circumstances. And I'm going to ask John in a second to come up and share about some of those things, about how two steps started. And two steps didn't start off as the program it is today. It started with an idea. It started with people who had conviction and passion. It started with people who rallied around it, that idea, and made it work. It worked because of the support of the church and the zeal and the enthusiasm of everyone around. And there's no reason why every church can't have something like that at some point. I don't mean necessarily tomorrow, but I think we need to dream for these sort of things and be able to reach out to our local areas in that way. And what we want to do is to be able to stimulate opportunities for more people to volunteer. Even in London, there are only limited things that we can offer you for you to get involved. And in effect, we're saying, if you want to help the poor with us, you've got to do it our way. And these are the things, take it or leave it. And we really actually want to provide more opportunities to volunteer. And so that people, one of the biggest reasons people don't volunteer is time. And there's a fear of getting involved with something that will take over your life. And I think we've got to be able to provide opportunities to volunteer that are opportunities for people with lots of time and opportunities for people with little time, but so that everyone can be involved. In London, we call what we have in London a Centre of Hope now, which is a concept Hope Worldwide is using internationally to to be able to describe what we do, because it's very hard to describe. What does Hope Worldwide? Hope Worldwide does a lot of different things, and you know, it's hard. And one of the things we can say is that we set up centres of hope where we meet different needs in that locality. And as we have the Moving On program, the mentoring program, Two Step for Homeless People, ODAP for Recovering Addicts, we're able to claim that, you know, we have multiple programs in one geographic location that are able to serve the poor, and we call it a centre of hope. And we would like to set up other centres of hope around the UK. And to start with, we have to start small, but we have big ambition, and we really want to engage all the churches in that. I'd like to ask John Knapp now, just to be able to share some of the things that he'd like to share about, you know, what it took to start Two Step. And welcome, John, up.
Thanks, Will. Great. I'm an ordinary bloke, okay, and 20 years ago I read a book called Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger, and it moved me to the core. It's still available, it's a bit dated, but it basically says that the mess we're in our world, and it's not got a lot better in that 20 years, shouldn't be, and we should be doing something about it. And we should be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. I then went to a conference, I can't remember where, but we were challenged. Every church was challenged to have a program that reaches out to the needy and to the poor. Came back from that conference and with a conviction, and for me that's the first thing, okay, if you've got a conviction, I must do something. We must do something. Okay. That's where it starts. There's a new Bible out called the Poverty and Justice Bible. It's all the scriptures on poverty and justice are coloured in orange. And there are over 2,100 scriptures directly related to poverty and justice in the Bible. For me, we didn't know what to do, but we came back and we made that commitment, we will do something. And we started looking. So the second step for us was, what are the needs? And it was very easy to just do something. One of the tempting things was just to do a soup run. But of course, there were lots of soup runs, and when we started really digging a little bit, we realised soup runs actually didn't do that much good. It made people on the street more comfortable, but it didn't get them off the street. And so we spent some time. We actually had two guys spend a month actually researching. So find out what the needs are. And in terms of this, I would say, don't be insular. And let's not be arrogant. Okay, there are a lot of other good people out there who are doing good things. Mm-hmm. There really are. And just learning from them, connecting with them, is a good way forward. I actually preached in Bristol and met a guy who said they were trying to start a night stop program that was based on something in Leeds, and they've been working on this for 18 months, but they hadn't quite got it together yet. So I got the address of the people in Leeds. I went up to Leeds, I looked at the night stop program there, which was basically churches having people who were homeless stay with them for one night and then going back to the government to get sorted out with benefits. Now we realised we couldn't do that because the church at that time, the government wouldn't work with us in that way, and it was different in London. And so we came up with a rent deposit thing, and we started really, really very, very small. Very quickly we saw the need for drug and alcohol work, because a lot of the people who were coming off the streets had a drink or drug problem, and we couldn't put them in people's homes. And the mechanics of it just happened. I mean, obviously, you know, it took more than one person, and I think that's the other thing that I would say. There's probably 35, 40 people here this morning. One of the things you can do is just to keep talking, enthuse. And I know some of you here have a real conviction and heart, and sometimes you feel like, what can I do? You can talk. You can talk in your church, you can talk in your congregation, and you can keep saying, let's do something, let's, you know, and you know, because that can spread. You can enthuse someone else. Someone enthuse me, and we can do that. And I think come up with something. There are lots of areas, starting small and doing something. And really, that's what I would say, and that's how I feel like God has blessed Hope here in London. Is that somebody decided we've got to do something. I pray that you can do that, and then get it. You'll find where there's a will, there's plenty of relatives. No, there's a way, all right. And you'll find a way, and I'll let Will carry on. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. That's great.
Where we're at now is that we have there's about 17, 18 congregations around the UK, currently having generally weekly collections. Most of them have a local Hope rep that allows us to communicate with that congregation. Often congregations will have a street collection, and possibly do something else that's fundraising related sometimes. Nearly all the congregations are actively involved in supporting programs overseas, and individuals often visit those overseas programs as well. And in London we have our ongoing programs, which gives various opportunities for volunteering, and there are churches around the UK, maybe four or five, that have set up some sort of local outreach of some sort, whether it be providing volunteers for something, working with a local hospital, doing different things that are sometimes unofficially called Hope programs in those places. And what we would like to do is build on all that. We would like to build on the fundraising capacity of all the churches. When we first had a street collection many years ago, I think it raised something like £80,000, whereas in the last 2 years it's raised around about £5,000. And I think people have lost sight of how much impact just a couple of hours in a year can make. And can you imagine what a difference that can make to people trying to help the poor? 5,000 or 80,000. I mean, that's a tremendous difference. And all that difference is about people deciding that morning, or when they set their diaries, I'll make that little bit of time. And for whatever reason, they can't, you know. And it's a very small thing, but actually has a huge impact, what we're able to do. I mean, something like that today would allow us to employ people into cities, maybe, to actually run programs in their cities. I mean, it's a massive difference. We would like to sort of build on... We know there is a great deal of goodwill amongst congregations towards Hope Worldwide, and I believe many Christians are actually very frustrated that there's nothing for them to do as well, and we want to somehow coordinate that, somehow bring it together, rally it together. It'd be great if congregations could have not just a Hope rep, but maybe a Hope team. They don't have to meet all the time, they don't have to get in the way of church calendars or anything else like that, but can support each other, and in the same way as John was sharing just now, allow for seeds of ideas to become something, because there's that mutual support to build on that, rather than for it to get squashed by our daily routines and everything else that goes on in our lives. We'd love to. I think it would be great to be able to have in each congregation a local collection to be able to support local volunteer work, so that people actively involved locally maybe can have their travel paid or something like that, or it can cover the costs of that might be associated with whatever that local outreach is. So that there's actually that mechanism to support the volunteers who want to get involved. And then we would like to be able to help and serve congregations by helping them set these things up, by supporting it, by giving ideas, by sharing ideas from different places, by maybe adopting the things already happening and helping to refine those, and then share the learning in one place to be able to put it in practice in another place, rather than always having to reinvent the wheel. There are a lot of good ideas around, and we can pass those around and act as that communication and conduit. One thing I think that Hope World Way can do is actually bridge a gap between churches and non-church people. We've heard already how some people feel about church. But actually a lot of people want to be involved in charity. And it's a safe place for people to come together and to be able to work together to help people. In America, they've been developing some volunteer opportunities that they've been calling seasons of service, where at different times of the year they'll organise just a specific thing that people can take time off, book in their diaries and get involved with. And by galvanising a large number of people on one day, you can actually have an incredible impact. A lot of churches have been doing this on Martin Luther King Day, and so that collectively across America, lots of churches are getting thousands and thousands of people out on one day to do something. And it could be a different thing each time. It doesn't have to be an ongoing program. It can be something that is a need right now in that community. And so in the past, it used to be maybe helping children make sure they had all their inoculations for maybe families who didn't have their health insurance, or different things like that. And more recently, they've galvanized people in support of sort of things like Hurricane Katrina and those sort of things, getting people involved in a response to a local emergency. And through that work, Hope have been able to build a partnership with the American Red Cross. It was the first time the American Red Cross have built a formal affiliated partnership with anybody, and it's with Hope Worldwide, which is quite remarkable when you think about where we came from, you know. And so it's that the impact can really spread when people can just come together and do something, and it's all to the glory of God. I think many of us really underestimate. I'm going to have a time check now. What time is it? Just in case. Oh, well, you've had a lot more time than I thought. I think when we give our time, we really underestimate the impact that it makes. Even an hour. Spending time with someone who's a moving on mentor, spending a bit of time with someone every couple of weeks has an amazing impact. And in a second, I'm going to ask Gavin to come up to share the impact he felt with going to a stopover. But before I go there, I want to leave a couple of thoughts with you to do with just volunteering in general. In Britain today, there was a survey last year. 36% of the British population gave their time to a cause at least once a month. That's over 20 million people are making time once a month to do something. Now I can look at that two ways. I can say, surely the Christians should be doing more than that. Or I can say, what an amazing opportunity. There's 20 million potential people who could help out in helping the poor. You know, now not all of them want to help the poor. Some of them volunteer at sports clubs or different things. But actually, there's 20 million people who are willing to give their time unpaid, which is an amazing amount of people. And, you know, there is this is where a connection can be formed. These guys are never going to volunteer for church programs if they don't go to church, but they might well volunteer for charities. And we have many people in London who are non-Christians who get involved and are happy to be involved, knowing we're a Christian charity, but it doesn't matter to them. When I was in Washington a few months ago, Hope Worldwide organised to be able to meet some congressmen, which was a very interesting experience. And one of them, a man called Jim Clyburn, said this. He said, "It is important to find something for which you are not paid. If your only success is in something for which you were paid, then you haven't been successful at all." And this guy, he was a quite a mature years African American, been through the whole civil rights thing, you know, now a congressman, And his career in politics came out of him doing voluntary work, stuff he wasn't paid to do, and so he had a lot of conviction about that. But I think there's a lot of truth in that. When I think about my life as a Christian, it's the things I volunteer to do that have taught me possibly the better lessons and changed me more than often the things that I was employed to do. And maybe because I give my heart more to those things, I don't know. Maybe it says a lot about what sort of employee I have. Maybe David closed your ears. But it's, I think it's true. I think, you know, there are opportunities for us. We're enriched when we volunteer in ways that we're not able to anticipate. We're going to ask Gavin to come up because he experienced stopover, and I'd like him to share what impact that really had on him.
Hi. For 8 years, I used Class A drugs, and for 6 years, smoked crack cocaine. Before my addiction, I had mortgage, job, everything that went with it. And when I started using crack cocaine, I lost everything: family, job. And through my addiction, I sold my home to fund my habit. I ended up organised in well-organised crime to fund my habit as well. Through that led to a prison sentence, and within prison I got clean, but when I came out there was no direction. I got housed again and to a new area, got a job, but with no guidance I fell back into addiction and homeless yet again, in hospital through my addiction, and I found myself back in London on the street, just wandering around, and quite happy really. I'd just given up. I had no contact with family, so I was excluded from my family, and I felt from the rest of society as well. I was just moved on everywhere, and I went to various homeless projects and tried to seek help for my addiction, but there didn't seem any help out there. And then one day I met Tommy, and Tommy sat me down and done an assessment, and I thought I was just going through the motions yet again, just go and see this guy, spend some time up there, get a cup of tea, break the day up. And for the first time someone seemed to listen to me and understand where I was at, and from then Tommy asked me to meet Toby and the guys at the treatment centre. So they accepted me onto the programme, but I had nowhere to stay while I was waiting to get into the programme, and that's where the stopover had come in. And I was told I could go to this person's house in the evening, stay there, and then go back down to the office every day. And so that was very strange. That was very strange. So the first night I went to the stopover, and for the first time I felt really broken, because on the way up there I sort of forced off the bus because of people making gestures, because of the way I smell. And I never really noticed that before, and you know, it's really strange that day as well, because I'd sat in the office with all the guys at home and everyone had just treated me normally, you know, and to experience that on the bus was a real shock. Anyway, I got to the house, and it was Rob and Katrina, and they just welcomed me in, sat me down, spoke with me, and I was treated like a normal human being, and there was no exclusion there, and they put me up for the night, and I was gone again in the morning at 7 o'clock, and I went back down the office, and I'd done that for a week, and it was only through the members of the church giving me a bed every night that I got into the treatment centre, you know, and I couldn't find any help like that all over London, you know. That the people in the church really sort of turned things around, and through that week gave me that grace to get into the treatment centre. And so then I got in the treatment centre, 6 months. I wasn't funded at all, so the treatment was all paid through the church. And that was just unbelievable, because whenever I ended up in hospital, or prison, there was no talk of funding, there was no talk of treatment or rehab. And that all happened just through the guys from the church paying the money every week for that. And then after I'd finished treatment, I didn't know which way I wanted to go, and I went back to the office and I started to talk with Tommy, and Tommy said, how about I go up there and volunteer? Now, I just didn't think I had anything to offer, and I thought, well, perhaps I could answer the phone every now and then or make some tea. But after a time, the guys really encouraged me, and my self-esteem came back, and they got me on a course, and from there I took a course, and again that was funded by the guys from the church and the Hope Project. So, and so from my work experience and my studying, I was offered a job with the guys as well, and that is something unbelievable. For like 2 years, just over 2 years, where I met the guys at Hope, where I met Tommy and JP, and my life turned around. And just in them 2 years, I've been offered more from them guys than anywhere else when I was looking for help. And I really feel that the guys at Hope, they gave me a way out instead of just a handout of like some soup or a blanket when I was sleeping on the floor. And it's just been an amazing experience.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Helen. I just want to leave us with a thought that actually there are thousands of Gavins around the country like that. And I just want to reread Matthew 5:14, which is, "You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on a stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men, that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven." Thank you.
Do you know how to turn this off?
No.
Isn't really that, is it?